From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've had 2 weeks of political conventions. Today, some analysis of how Republicans presented their nominee and their case.
And their goal was to simply to remind those guys on the economy, on abortion, and to swing out Melania and Ivanka Trump. And say, you know what? He's kind of rough around the edges, but you know you'd rather go with the conservative Republican policy than what the Dems are offering.
The economy's in tatters. COVID's not going all that well. We're at a racially really tenuous point in the country. And he's the president, so he's kind of stuck with all three of those things.
Also, we meet a man from Monroe who convinced his hometown to rethink George Armstrong Custer.
Personally, I think that just tearing down a statue by yourself with a truck is not a powerful statement. But winning over the hearts and minds of Monroe County and coming to a Democratic vote, perhaps, or through the Democratic process to make changes, that's powerful.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we have some analysis of what happened at the Democratic and Republican conventions over the past couple of weeks and what Michigan voters might take away from them.
It's clear by most of the data that Michigan's probably on the second tier of target states.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, teachers in Detroit have reportedly reached a deal to return to classrooms this fall. With COVID still at large, many educators have had concerns about the terms under which they might be teaching face-to-face this fall. But Detroit Public Schools Community District has apparently struck a deal that involves classes capped at 20 students, bonuses for teachers who are willing to be face-to-face, and the right to choose teaching in-person or online instruction. While the deal brings the district a step closer to a full restart after Labor Day, the fall situation still looks so complicated for schools all over Michigan. Michigan Radio hosted a discussion this week called Keep Calm and Teach On, discussing the return to classes. And our guests included Jametta Lilly of the Detroit Parent Network, Robin Murray, a teacher at Lansing Eastern High School, and Matinga Ragatz, Stateside's education commentator and a former Michigan Teacher of the Year. I asked our panel how teachers and parents can even make plans in a situation that seems to be changing, sometimes day to day. Let's hear from Robin first.
I think that we once again have to look at this as being very unprecedented. And we have all talked about that through any master's program, any dialogue with colleagues, that we're no longer an agricultural country. So therefore, our education system is 100 years dated. But you're going from one extreme to another extreme without any kind of pre-warning. So you're going to have to be able to look at this as small segments of time. It might move us forward to looking at year-round schooling. We're going to have to really, even after COVID, and I'm going to claim after COVID, we're going to have to change our educational system time frame, and we're going to also have to look at that there's going to be that hybrid mix just to think about snow days. There are going to be so many ways that we can keep education moving in a positive mode in the future. But to answer your question right now, I would say that if I was in a classroom, I would be looking at first marking period and doing the very best I can do for first marking period, having a backup plan for asynchronous learning, making sure I had my synchronous strategy, and then I would also have in person. And most educators, I think that Matinga would chime in and support me on this, we always have two or three different backup plans for
the backup plan.
We just have to.
Yep, hashtag tiny wins.
Matinga, I know how deep your commitment goes to looking at innovative ways of schooling, but I also know how in touch you are with the realities that a lot of teachers face in terms of having to show some kind of, you know, measurability for what's going to happen this year. What do you think teachers will do to try to come up with their plans?
You know, teachers have the ability to land like Spider-Man, but I really want to speak to administrators and I want to speak to the people that the decision makers, especially regarding standardized testing. Like, what exactly are you trying to evaluate during a national emergency, right? So yes, we can teach your children, but not to the standard of that test right now. Yes, if you allow us to figure new things out, we can reach a new group of students. We can really make things equitable for all kids, but we got to try different things. So this is a very experimental year. If the decision makers decide, listen, let's just, you know, have each other's back and make this year a successful year for our kids and for our teachers, I think that you will see a lot of success. And you see a lot of innovation and you'll see a lot of creativity come through. But as long as this, you know, words like rigor and words like we got to keep up with this and we got to keep up with that and we got to fall behind, as long as we have that mentality, again, it's like trying to assess a population in the middle of a war. You know, sure, you might come up with some numbers, but what exactly are those numbers for? This message is more so for the decision makers to really just relax this year and give us an opportunity to forget the education we had and really look for the education that we want, that we could use and that would really, really help our kids, all our kids, not just some who can afford it.
Jimena, Lily. Oh, please go ahead, Robin.
I'm sorry to interrupt. One of the things that our district is doing for the first 2 or 3 weeks, we're really focusing in on not curriculum, but really mindset, cultural connections, wellness checks. So I do think that the district is really taking some time to make sure, are you okay? That wellness check. Here's some tools. I just see a humility. And I've been a teacher now for 20 years, 14 years in the city of Flint, but I've never really seen the collaboration on the levels as I've seen this year. In terms of districts saying, come on, let's come together as one. I don't want to sound like I'm sugarcoating anything, but I just think it's worth putting out there that our executive team, at least in Lansing School District, they're saying, we want you to focus on understanding what our babies have been through. This is coming from people that I never have heard that kind of conversation. Concentrate on the babies. Mm-hmm. Understand what they're going through. When you're on those Zoom conferences, if that child does not want their video up, you be mindful that you don't know what their circumstances are. We're being trained to understand what these children may be going through. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get emotional, but I see it. I hear it. People are coming through. Stakeholders throughout the state of Michigan are embracing us and saying we are here to help you. Mm-hmm. Each district is going to have maybe different challenges and different ways that they're going to go about virtual, hybrid, or whatever the case may be. But I'm coming to y'all sincerely from the heart. Mm-hmm. I see it. Mm-hmm. I feel it.
It is so easy to lose sight of some of that as the debate has gotten louder in the political arena, and the fact that Black families are facing, you know, a generational cataclysm right now, and families all over Michigan from every background have faced disruptions and economic hardships and just everything all at once. Mm-hmm. Jimena Lilly, we got a question from somebody who's watching right now that's not unrelated to this. And that question of how you go forward in a time of extreme uncertainty, and we can say trauma. We can say trauma. Danielle says, how can I help convince major employers in Michigan to provide more flexibility for parents and maybe students learning from home? I wonder if you could answer Danielle's question and maybe add if there's anything else, if it goes beyond just outreach to the work world.
Well, the extraordinary thing is actually business throughout the state of Michigan really is aware that we are behind in education and is talking about the need precisely for innovation. We see anywhere from the regional chambers, there are groups of businesses that are calling for actually equity, who are now finally realizing how important childcare is and are trying to look at resources for that. So I think one of the things is to find out in your area, what are the businesses or business sectors that are working around issues for growth and development? Because literally anybody who does anything that has to do with economics knows how important education is. So I would invite that person to take a look at just going online. EdTrust is what I would suggest. There is the Michigan Launch, which is a combination of both nonprofit and profits working together. What are the strategies that businesses can put and partner with other systems? But I would encourage anyone is get that data, get those voices, and share that with your company. I think you'll be delighted, and it may really help. The other thing I have to go here. So on one hand, all of us are excited about the notion that we know educating and lifelong learning can be so much more than it is in this country. I mean, there's so many other beautiful examples internationally in particular. Yet there's another bug that we just have to address the issue in the room is COVID. We are in a pandemic. We're in a situation where it is natural for teachers, the people who are so vital to our education, to have questions about, am I going to be safe? And then parents, we understand more and more from our pediatricians, and certainly we're hearing more about them from not only the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, and others. We don't really know fully how this disease is impacting children. So there are some unknowns, and there are some things that I think in order for us to get to that place of creativity and innovation and power and partnership, we've also got to make sure that we're trying to create an environment that is as much as risk-free as we can. There's no such thing as totally risk-free. But has that district created a plan for face-to-face that is protective to children and is protective to teachers? And people have to have that dialogue. And if it's not there, then don't send your children there. And we're hearing teachers say, until I feel comfortable, I prefer to do this. So there has to be some give and take, because the reality is that COVID is part of our new reality while we're at the same time trying to move ourselves forward.
Jametta Lilly is the CEO of the Detroit Parent Network. She's also an appointee to Governor Whitmer's Coronavirus Racial Disparities Task Force. We also heard from Matinga Ragatz, an educator with 25 years classroom experience. She's also Stateside's education commentator. And Robin Murray, a teacher from Lansing Eastern High School. The discussion, called Keep Calm and Teach On, was part of Michigan Radio's Issues and Ales series, hosted via Zoom this past week. You can find a video of the whole event at michiganradio.org. In just a moment, we'll hear how the city of Monroe has decided to reinterpret its statue of George Armstrong Custer with help from one of the city's Native American citizens.
Coming from a member of a tribe who states that this person massacred us, I would never want people to forget about Custer and what he did.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A big part of our national conversation about representation and Americans' relationship to history concerns our landmarks. This summer, the city of Monroe decided to update its downtown statue of George Armstrong Custer, the U.S. cavalry commander who led many campaigns against Native people and who was ultimately killed by a coalition of Native forces at Little Bighorn. The change was spurred by an online petition, and one of the names on that petition is that of Dr. Graham Denton, a chiropractor with offices in Monroe who has some personal history that informed his involvement. Dr. Denton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. I do appreciate it.
You grew up in Monroe, yes?
Yes. Was born here, graduated from Monroe High in 2002, and have returned about roughly just under 3 years ago to pursue chiropractic locally.
When you were growing up, what did you learn about General Custer?
You know, actually, I went to Meadow Montessori School, but graduated from the high school. And so I felt that they were allowing for a more progressive classroom. They weren't afraid to shy away. And I think that's because they had such a diverse student base compared to other schools in the area. They actually allowed my mother to come and speak a few times, especially concerning Columbus Day, and just to inform the classrooms in general about our culture. And I've found that those who are educated in that way have been some of the biggest proponents for the statue being relocated to a more appropriate historical site or museum.
Would you tell us a little bit about your family?
Yes, my mom is full blood Cheyenne. We are both members of the Cheyenne Arapaho tribe out of Oklahoma. And that is the southern branch. My father and her moved here. They're originally born in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which is the end of the Trail of Tears, actually. They met in high school. He mostly can identify with white European background, but he is a member of the Cherokee tribe as well.
Yeah.
But I guess if you want to run it percentage-wise, that would just make me about a 16th Cherokee also, more Cheyenne.
How did the Custer statue that's in Monroe come to be on your radar this year?
It was actually, I was approached by Katie Beth Davis, who I graduated high school with, and the context for her coming was because she was highly involved with Black Lives Matter. And I don't know if it was someone driving by while they were protesting or if it was a comment in Facebook, but I believe someone taunted her and said, "Isn't that ironic that you're fighting for equality under the shadow of General Custer?" And that motivated her just enough to start this petition. And I believe she knew I was Native, but I'm not sure that she knew that I was Cheyenne and how intimately involved that tribe has been with in the American Indian War concerning Custer's campaign, along with Sheridan.
I believe it was the Cheyenne Arapaho tribal members who Custer was fighting at Little Bighorn when he was killed, right?
That is correct. He was fighting the northern band of our tribe.
Ah.
And those are representative of the branch called the Dog Warriors. And they're sort of our military branch of Cheyenne culture. We are of the Southern Cheyenne tribe who sought peace with the U.S. government on the reservations. And actually, we unfortunately also ran into Custer even while seeking peace and were massacred. The Northern branch also destroyed him at Little Bighorn along with the Lakota Sioux and a couple other tribes that should be recognized. And that's basically me identifying as a Monroe resident, but also someone who is intimately linked to the history of Custer. And, you know, to be honest, I was just surprised that other people felt this way about Custer. That's why I never spoke up while going to Monroe High School or anything like that. I did find the textbooks a little bit lacking in information. I don't know if they try to persuade that Custer was this great person, but I certainly think that the representation around him now should be changed with the education.
Do you find that some people in Monroe feel like a positive personal connection or feeling about him?
Absolutely. And it would be egregious to underestimate and try not to understand where they're coming from. I completely understand that, especially because of his involvement in the Civil War. So with this movement and how it's happened, when speaking with opponents who will hear me out, I just go ahead and concede that. I say, yeah, sure. We'll consider him a Civil War hero. We can get that out of the way. And that's why you're defending, you know, his involvement, especially with other monuments coming down that are more Confederate related. You know, maybe there's some confusion there. Absolutely. And so, yep, there's some hometown pride. We have a Custer Week, even, where little children of the elementary schools come around and are taught about his Civil War achievements. I just would like... You know, and City Hall's kind of went this way too, with trying to do equal representation. Let's learn about his involvement in the American Indian War campaigns. Basically, what I'm saying is he probably should have just became a career politician after his involvement in the Civil War. And that's why he's such an interesting historical figure that makes him so polarizing. It would not do justice to people to say that good people cannot do bad things and bad people cannot do good things. That's simply untrue. And, you know, we should take a look at that. Absolutely.
How did you and Katie Beth and the other folks involved decide what to ask of the city about regarding the statue? I mean, there are some people who feel like, you know, monuments need to come down and some who feel like it's important to have them stand, but to have them stand in a different context and with maybe some different information that people can use to understand history. How did you decide which way you'd try to go with it?
Absolutely. Personally, being a part-time history minor in undergrad, I wouldn't want to see history erased, which is what a lot of the opponents of this relocation said to us. It's hard for me to understand how putting it in a museum where we go to study history would be erasing that history. And if anything, coming from a member of a tribe who states that this person massacred us, I would never want people to forget about Custer and what he did, which I think is somewhat what's happening with all of this. Because you just don't want something like that to ever happen again. The difference being the statues and their locations can glorify certain members. And I understand why they want that glorification because of the Civil War. And they argue that alone. But they just don't look at the whole picture, even on the plaque of the statue, you know. There's one little sentence. And he was also involved in the American Indian Wars, I believe is all it says. And it's like, well, and
the understatement of the century.
Absolutely. And, you know, my personal belief is, I'm not sure if I can speak for anyone else here, but, you know, my personal belief has always been, you know, why I'm involved in this, I'm usually a private person, my family are private people. But there was a conscious shift when I saw what was happening on the news. It looked to me like what was happening in the textbooks in the 1960s. And as a historian, I said, are we going to repeat that?
You mean the Black Lives Matter protests that have been in our streets for several months now?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, there was a consciousness shift there. And I said, wow, that just shouldn't happen again. You know, it's been a long time and maybe I need to wake up.
Well, at this point, 13,800 people plus signed the petition asking for a change. And the group was able to reach a compromise with the city. What did the city agree to do?
To be honest, I want to thank them and their involvement through this. At first, it looked like it was going to go exactly how it was based on the demographics of Monroe County. I didn't even think they would listen, really. But, you know, they have, and their response has been pretty good through all this. So I want to mention that. And the agreement is that a new installation of history will be done. I'm not sure if that just means a plaque or several plaques. They hope it's a little bit grander. I've actually been privileged to have a few private meetings with just the city manager and the city council recently after this compromise. The city manager is the one who knows about the most about this project. And I asked him, do you want to just encompass Custer's actual involvement in the American Indian War? And he stated, no, not just that. He wants the entire context of the American Indian War to be portrayed. And the reason for that is they've just done a new Battlefield of River Raisin installation. And that attempts to, you know, tell history in an accurate portrayal also. And that just didn't portray the native populations well mm-hmm. in the area. And that's because at the time of that history, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And so there's a drive in Monroe to have this accurate information. And so when some of their citizens came to them and said, you need to look at all of it, I think that they agreed because of that reason. And so it is their hope to accurately portray history. And I kind of jokingly asked the city manager, Vincent Pastu, do you think Monroe County is ready for that? If you actually install what happened, because a lot of people will say, you know, there is the opinion that a genocide and a massacre was committed there. And I've heard all reasons from all opponents arguing why Custer and things like that. And I'm definitely prepared to logically meet them and talk about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Graham Denton. He's a chiropractor with offices in Monroe, the town where he grew up. He's also a citizen of the Cheyenne Arapaho Southern Band. Have you ever visited Little Bighorn or another site that Custer was involved in and seen like sort of how some of these historical markers have been updated?
You know, I haven't been able to, but I've talked to people who went to Sand Creek in Colorado. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. That's the only national monument with the word massacre in it.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask about Little Bighorn is it's one of those sites that has been updated with some additional information and, you know, markings and plaques that talk about what happened. And actually, though, it has been done in such a way you can definitely tell that these things were added later. And I just wondered if you have any thoughts on, is it important to recognize that sometimes history is evaluated and reevaluated, or are there reasons to think that we might need to design our monuments in such a way that these things don't look like an addendum?
Yes, absolutely. I think that a few opponents of what we're doing would say, how can you judge, you know, Custer on the scope of now? And I, you know, you'd have to agree. You would absolutely have to take in the historical context of the time. But I still think there are people out there, including myself, that would argue that even by today's standards and the standards back then, that he could be labeled as a war criminal. And I realize that's kind of a slippery slope definition. But, you know, I think that when they install these new installations here, talking about his involvement in the American Indian War, if they bring in the actual expert to explain it to him, they this is sort of to uncover a truth that was probably lost for various reasons throughout the decades. You know, it's hard sometimes. And I saw this when I visited South Africa. It was quite different, but you had people talking about apartheid because there was an official government apology. So it just, it was a different landscape than what happens in America. But it's hard to, I'm sure it would be hard for someone to say that their ancestors, you know, participated in some of these events. It's hard to remember how this country was founded. You took this land from one people, you had another people work it for free. And now that cycle that people are saying there's repercussions through that throughout history. And that's sort of what embodies to me the Black Lives Matter movement. I would start with saying, you know, of course, history is written by the victors. And so that's not a surprise in a lot of cases that there's misrepresentations of the facts when that can happen. I'm just calling for, in this event, in relation to Custer, for people to look at all the facts, actually, because I think that they're only looking at his Civil War campaign. And if they actually knew the true information on his American Indian War campaign, they potentially might feel differently about how he's represented in the town.
You know, I think a lot of times white Americans may see issues like this as less important than some other things going on in their lives in this moment, because they don't think that they know any Native people. Is there anything that we can and should be doing about that?
You know, I think, again, you have plenty of educational opportunities. Through this whole process, I've been blessed to increase my Rolodex with people who really want to make a difference in Monroe County. And I'm not saying whatever side of the political spectrum they're on, they want to make a difference and help people. And that's really what's important. And so, I think that there's educational opportunities. And what I was going to say is I met the director of the Rotary Club, the local Rotary Club. And he said, you know, we have someone come in once or twice a month of a different culture and just simply explain. And I go, that sounds familiar. That sounds like what my mother was doing for the Monroe Meadow Montessori School when I attended it. And that's great because people, again, understand the issues and they get involved because they just see it as a simple fact. So I would start there, definitely. And not just with Native people, of course. Unfortunately, we get grouped together, and that's a dangerous thing that I'm seeing with everything, grouping all Black Lives Matter protesters together, grouping all maybe possibly right-wing counter-protesters together, grouping all Natives. There's hundreds of tribes in this country. And obviously, I'm not even educated on all the ways of the tribe, but I would definitely start there with just simple education on each culture would lead to further understanding, less cognitive dissonance about what's happening and less confusion, which might lead to more confrontation, which is, in a sense, what I'm seeing when looking at this whole thing from an interpretation of history, if you will. I really thought that it was important that the way that this group moved about doing it was we wanted to use the democratic process as opposed to having, you know, tearing it down in different manner. Even, you know, even if the mayor of Monroe came and just ripped it down, I'm not sure if that's a complete victory for this group, because again, you've alienated the majority of the population here in Monroe County. So the way we've went about it, I really have enjoyed. And even city council has mentioned on their meetings, you know, just the way that we've done it without committing any crimes, without turning towards violence, of course, because that was why I asked, why were they so initially apprehensive to meet with us? And they said, honestly, we just didn't know who you were. And with everything going on in Detroit and a few of our city council members are up there, we weren't sure if you were a violent group or not. And I said, fair enough. But now that you've met me in the way that I speak as a Monroe County resident, you know, moving forward, I am excited to see what the city does with this. Because in my hopes that there still be an education for the county on what General Custer represents. And there's still movement forward with this, because just yesterday at a Monroe County school board meeting, Katie Beth Davis called for the changing of the Custer Elementary School as well. So we'll see kind of where this goes.
You know, I hate to qualify, but I'm sure that there are some folks who live in Detroit who may be listening to this conversation right now and saying, you know, wait a minute, that's not what I saw at our protests. Is it hard that you may have to be confronting people's perceptions of what's going on in other places, in other parts of the country, even as you're trying to get them to hear your own conversation about what could be happening in your town?
Absolutely. That is a double-edged sword in this case, because at the same time, the momentum for all of this, I realize, is because of the polarized state of politics in this current situation. But that's the leading driving motivational force behind this movement, bringing attention to the Custer statue. But at the same time, I've had to backtrack a few times and tell people, look, I'm not throwing firebombs you know, and things like that, that I would, like I said, myself denounce. I completely understand why someone who feels that way would act out in that manner. But I don't, just because you understand something doesn't mean you have to condone it or agree with it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would say that that's important, you know, in that sense that we've acted differently, because otherwise people would just not hear that message. But also you've had to defend yourself at times because people think that you're sending a completely different message than you are. We've always from the start wanted to be, of course, nonviolent, because these are my neighbors. I don't want to upset 90% of my neighbors in Monroe County. If anything, I knew that this would be an aggressive message, that they had some hometown pride towards this person. And so I made sure for this campaign to always go home and be able to look myself in the mirror and just say that the way that you've done this is through education, and then you made them make up their own decision. It's not fair of me to force the hand of 90% of Monroe County if they don't want that. But if I bring them truth and they say that they still want this gentleman, well, fair play to them. Then, you know, that's a different conversation we can have. Yeah. But I guess there are steps to everything. And I always knew that this government process would be, oh, in my opinion, I thought it was a 5 to 10 year project. And if not further, if they don't relocate the statue after that.
Dr. Graham Denton lives in Monroe and works there as well. Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you again.
After a short break, we're going to get some analysis of the Republican and Democratic conventions as they've played out over the past 2 weeks, and which messages might resonate most with Michiganders. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Democratic and Republican parties have made their cases. Joe Biden and Donald Trump have accepted their party's nominations for president and pitched their woo to the American people. Now all that's left is for Michigan voters to buckle down for weeks of campaigning, pandemic style. With us to talk about the conventions and the issues that emerged are John Selleck, consultant and founder of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs, and a Republican. Also with us today, Adrian Hemant, political consultant and partner at Grassroots Midwest, a Democrat. Gentlemen, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, good morning. You make it sound like returning to hardcore political season is a bad thing.
Oh, you're a better man than I, Selleck. All right, so what did you two think of President Trump's speech last night? John?
I think the president delivered the speech he needed to. It's pretty clear that maybe the first half or three quarters was, you know, Donald Trump on a teleprompter following message, hitting all the messages he needed to, and then he went off, probably, teleprompter. And that's a sort of a, like, as a sub-issue, a thing with him. He didn't get popular because he was reading a teleprompter like every other politician. He got popular because he was Trump riffing. Sometimes he really struck out and missed, and sometimes he hit home runs. And that's what got him to where he's at. But we're at a far different place right now. He is the president. He needs to reassure people that left the party in 2018 that it's okay. Give them permission to kind of come back based on all these people that spoke as third party validators. And for the most part, I think he probably accomplished what he could with his speech and with his convention.
So it's interesting. The blocks that made the difference for Donald Trump in 2016 were white voters, college educated white voters, some upper and middle class white voters who apparently we saw exiting the party in the midterm elections in 2018. But what specifically, which part of that speech was aimed at them? Was it the first part on the teleprompter or the second part invoking a lot of fear?
I'll just look at it in the bigger picture. First of all, let's just admit to ourselves, these aren't conventions. We keep calling it that, but that's not what they are. Conventions are done and over with. In those big giant rooms full of people who actually had to make decisions, that was way in the past. And those big giant arenas are probably just a legacy of the past. What we have now are scripted TV miniseries, one for the Democrats, one for the Republicans. Got some Democrats in a room with some TV producers, got some Republicans in a room with TV producers, and they very carefully scripted out an 8 to 10 hour miniseries that was aimed to do two things. One, the most important thing, to unify and rally their troops. It was really important for the Democrats to kind of solder together the progressives and the moderates to go forward and keep the focus on Trump and not boil down into a fight over their differences inside their party. Trump and the Republicans needed to rally and excite their own people. I think they probably did that. And then beyond that, each one wanted to reach slightly further. So I think, you know, the Democrats were aiming to continue to pull suburban women into the party, and they were really worried about motivating their youth and their Black votes. The Republicans were rallying their base and then trying to just bring back people that, all things being equal or in a vacuum, would vote for Republican policy over the policy that seems to be coming out of the Democratic Party. And their goal was to simply to remind those guys on the economy, on abortion, and to swing out Melania and Ivanka Trump and say, you know what, he's kind of rough around the edges, but you know you'd rather go with the conservative Republican policy than what the Dems are offering.
Adrian, tell me what you saw last night.
I thought that was an exceptionally bizarre performance on a number of counts. Number one, the speech was long, the longest acceptance speech in history, topping his own record from 2016. We thought Bill Clinton was verbose, but it turns out we were wrong. The other thing was, I thought it was a really interesting choice for the president and his team to frame him as the law and order president while they were engaged in a federal crime, a violation of the Hatch Act at the White House. So I thought that that was some sort of delightful irony. But the speech was sort of trying to do two contradictory things at once. It was trying to rally the base, which at this point, the base of the Republican Party is non-college educated white voters. And at the same time was trying to make the president palatable to the suburban voters that he's hemorrhaging, especially women, but suburban voters in general. And unfortunately for the president and his team, the appeals that they're trying to make to these two groups are wildly different. You know, the first two thirds of the speech and the last third of the speech both sort of accomplished what they were trying to do, but they were kind of at cross purposes.
I wondered how much of the speech may have had an opposite effect from what was intended. We know that one of the things that also helped Donald Trump in 2016 was the fact that a lot of Black voters stayed home, especially in places like Detroit. Do you think any of the coded language meant to inspire fear in maybe white suburban voters might have had an opposite effect on Black voters and others who may have been tuning in for this as well?
I think that's absolutely the case. And this is, again, an example of the sort of contradiction that the Trump campaign is trying to sell, right? On the one hand, they like to talk about, you know, at least pre-pandemic, low Black unemployment numbers. They like to tout this, their corrections reform bill. But in the very next breath, the president's talking about, you know, longer sentences, prosecuting people to the full extent of the law, and, you know, cracking down on dissent and protest, and, you know, locking up more people in cities. So I think this is another example of the president really sort of working at cross purposes. And that sort of gives away the game to both sides. It gives away the game to Black voters, certainly. But it also gives away the game to some of these more affluent college educated suburbanites. You know, they can kind of see through the double game that's being played here.
Well, and that tension was apparent last night for sure as they went back and forth. But I think what the campaign is attempting to do in the bigger picture is to deliver a message that you've been with the Democratic Party. Joe Biden kind of takes you for granted in his comments repeatedly. And when we weren't faced with COVID, I had the economy really humming and we had the lowest unemployment rate for African Americans and maybe forever. So let's talk about this in a bigger picture. And I don't necessarily think that their goal is to actually be able to win a lot more votes right now, but it is to make it to put Trump in a less negative position with that plot.
To make him seem more palatable to white voters who saw some of the Black people who were shown at the speech last night, and to make them feel like maybe this guy isn't as racist as people say.
Well, I think there's two different there's a lot of complicated information flowing out of both of these conventions, and if we think that the majority of it isn't all planned on the Democrat and the Republican side straight out of polling and focus groups, then we're fooling ourselves. President Trump certainly is the one person in this whole menagerie who tends to go with his gut and say whatever he's thinking at the moment, which leads to kind of a zigzag path instead of a linear path. But both sides are being very careful with their words and positioning. But in that case, yes, they're trying to make sure that white voters who left the party in 2018 are given permission, so to speak, that's the way I've seen it phrased, to think, okay, he's not that bad, and I can really vote my pocketbook or my policy side instead of what I'm seeing on Twitter all day long. But I don't think there's any doubt he's attempting to send a message to the African-American community as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Selleck of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs and Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest about the conventions and all the speeches of the past couple of weeks. I wanted to ask you both what surprised you about these conventions, if anything. Adrian, is there anything that came to mind for you either this week or last?
You know, I think the last week, the one surprising thing for me was that Joe Biden didn't try to prosecute a little bit more of a sort of positive case about moving the country forward. I think from the Republican side, you know, I already sort of pointed to this. I was surprised that the president and his campaign couldn't really pick a lane. Every time they tried to dive into sort of rallying the base, like John was talking about, you know, they sort of pulled back a little bit. I think recognizing the sort of contradictions we were talking about in this strategy. But ultimately, I was really surprised that they didn't pick a lane. You know, John mentioned that, you know, part of how Donald Trump was successful in 2016 was sort of being himself and not, you know, not listening to the sort of messaging experts and such. I really expected him to go with his sort of full-throated base appeal. And they kind of tried to tap dance around the line. I think it was actually a little bit less effective. And that speech last night was the other surprising thing. I was really surprised that the speech that was written for Donald Trump wasn't more in the 25 to 30 minute range, because you know he's going to go off script. You know he's going to speak extemporaneously in addition to whatever you write for him. And that speech clocked in at like an hour and 15 minutes. That was crazy.
John, what was surprising to you about what we saw the past couple of weeks?
Not a lot was surprising overall. I mean, we're facing a post-COVID era of communicating now digitally. And I think most of America is probably awkwardly getting used to watching canned videos and Zoom videos and bad audio. And so these presentations probably were just sort of ho-hum. And I think that was reflected in the ratings. Both parties had much lower TV viewing ratings than we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a sign for what's going to happen in the future. But on the policy side of things, the issue to me that still did not get enough coverage, which is it should be to Trump's benefit, is the economy. The economy is in a bad place. And we see the headlines every day about the stock market flying high. But we need to be paying attention to the stories about individual people who are terrified that they can't pay their bills. And really, that's what Trump has to be counting on, that people don't feel that the people that were soft Republicans or supported Trump for one reason or another in the past and started drifting away because of his style start to feel that because of the economy, they don't have the luxury of voting on any other issue but the economy and their family's economic security. Biden spent, I thought, too much time on empathy. They did it very well. But he didn't talk about the economy enough because that is where Trump seems to always hold a slight edge on all polling. It's the one lane he still has here. Trump should have talked more about the economy. They did, but I don't think as much. He talked more about fear to motivate those people. So I guess the economy not getting more of a center stage surprised me. I think Governor Whitmer in her remarks and Gary Peters, they clearly were focused on the auto industry and the UAW, both by doing, you know, Governor Whitmer did her speech at the UAW. Gary Peters stood in front of some cars. He got teased and mocked for looking like a used car salesman on cable comedy shows. But they were trying to go the economy or the economic route. And I think both conventions should have done more of that.
A question for both of you. Was there anything in particular that Michiganders could really chew on or should be paying attention to within the last couple of weeks of speeches and messaging? John?
No, and I hate to sound now like I'm the cynical one, but politics right now is a very intense game. And with all the different channels that we have to receive information and how unhappy people are in general about how things are going, I think they just feel like they're being bombarded with an unbelievable level of information. And the media is shouting, screaming about this happened and that happened, and Trump shouting and Biden is shouting, and everyone's going back and forth. You can't even bring up politics on Facebook without getting into a fight with your friends. You know, I tend to feel that these conventions probably are going to be forgotten about by next week, just like the impeachment and Iran and every other thing that comes along. And we're dependent on what is the last issue, who has the ball last at the end of the campaign.
Speaking of the last word, Adrian, I think you might have it here. What did you see that Michigan voters could or should pay attention to at the conventions?
You know, I think John's point about the economy is right. And, you know, I think, you know, that being said, this was eminently forgettable, as John says. And unlike a normal convention, you know, you didn't really stumble across this by accident. right? You went looking for this if you wanted to see it, which in terms of motivating the bases, I feel like the Democrats did a little bit better job with that. You know, Republicans, because they're down in the polling, were really trying to tap dance between the base and the center, the more moderate folks. So I think the thing to watch down the stretch here is ultimately not anything to do with these conventions. It's what does the economy look like and what does COVID look like? And, you know, as a sort of additional issue with that, you know, how much worse does the race relations situation get in the country in terms of the racial awakening that's going on right now and the reaction to it? Those three issues are going to determine who wins the election. And unfortunately for Donald Trump, he's the president right now. And so I think that that's, you know, the focus on those three issues is probably bad. The economy's in tatters. COVID's not going all that well. And, you know, we're at a racially really tenuous point in the country. And he's the president. So he's kind of stuck with all three of those things.
You know, it was interesting. I think it was during Ivanka Trump's speech last night, she made a reference to Wisconsin dairy farmers. We realized that there wasn't really a Michigan call out for anybody who was looking for it in I guess any of the speeches that were made. That may not be entirely surprising, given that the Trump campaign is not even advertising right now. But what does that indicate anything to either of you about Michigan's standing at the top of the ticket?
It doesn't necessarily, but it's clear by most of the data that Michigan's probably on the second tier of target states. We do see the vice president of the United States coming to Michigan today. So it's clear that Michigan has to remain on that second tier because, frankly, for the Republicans, anywhere the map has expanded, it expanded in the wrong way. It expanded to Arizona, expanded to Ohio, to North Carolina. That's all Republican turf. So Michigan, they can't afford to take it off the map. And by sending Vice President Trump here today, or Vice President Pence here today, they're trying to keep things, the lights on. And in case they need to come back here full speed.
Should John James be worried about the lack of attention to Michigan? Adrian, what are your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. John James should be worried about it. Republicans in the State House of Representatives should be worried about it, too. The top of the ticket drives elections. That's almost always been true, but it's certainly true in this era of negative partisanship. The top of the ticket drives elections. Spending by the top of the ticket helps drive the outcome of elections. If the Republican presidential campaign is not on the air and spending here, it's hard to see a path to victory for John James. And it becomes a lot more possible for House Democrats to flip the State House of Representatives.
You know, and I'd probably argue the opposite. To some extent, a lot of what Adrian says rings true. But trying to compete at the local level, either at the U.S. Senate or the State House, with the hurricane level amount of spending that would happen with presidential messaging is nearly impossible. And you're stuck kind of grabbing on to the train for a ride when you're at those lower levels. What's going to happen if Trump is not dominating the airwaves in Michigan is that the conversation will not fully be about Trump all the time. It will actually allow for more oxygen for John James to take his message at Gary Peters and reverse, and for those House candidates to actually break through a little bit through all the noise.
Yeah, I think that that's largely correct in terms of the messaging environment, but I think exactly the opposite in terms of turnout. The reason that spending from the top of the ticket matters is turning your voters out to the polls, motivating them to show up. State House races certainly don't motivate voters to show up. Sometimes a U.S. Senate race can. You know, what really motivates people to show up is the top of the ticket. They may make different decisions further down the ballot, but that the lack of those dollars for coordinated turnout operations is a problem.
The only thing that might counter that a little bit, I noticed, is in the Dem convention, they didn't use Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and Kerry Washington and others solely to inspire. When you listen closely, they were pleading with the young voters, with African-American voters, to please make sure you actually show up and vote. They've made the choice to not go door to door to eliminate their best way of connecting to people. And they are having to do their turnout solely on pleading, begging, and digital. They're a little nervous about those people showing up and not just being cynical and staying home. And we've seen in most of the national polling, the Trump supporters, when they ask who's most excited, Trump tends to be ahead of Biden by quite a bit. So that'll be a negating factor to some extent going forward. But sure, would the Republicans rather have a ton of spending here at the top? Of course they would. But there, it's a complicated set of issues.
John Selleck of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs. We've also been talking with Adrian Hemond at Grassroots Midwest. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That is Stateside for this week. The show is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. We get help from our interns, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Monday.